Welcome back to The Deep Dive. We are here to take your sources, articles, and research and give you the ultimate shortcut to being well-informed. Today, we're doing a deep dive into what might be one of the most game-changing pieces of music ever recorded. Bob Dylan's 1965 masterpiece, Like a Rolling Stone.
It's a huge one.
It is. So our mission today is pretty simple. Let's pull apart the origins of this song, the messy, angry, personal crisis that actually birthed it.
And the recording sessions, too, which were just, you know, chaotic, full of these happy accidents that made the sound.
Exactly. And then we'll get into the powerful, biting meaning of the lyrics. We're going to try to explain why the 6-minute track didn't just top the charts. It completely redefined what rock music could even be.
It's more than just a famous song. It really is a seismic shift. I mean, when you look back at the history of 20th century music, this is the exact moment Dylan changes.
Right.
He goes from being the acoustic folk poet, the, you know, spokesperson for a generation.
Which he hated.
Hated it. And he becomes this electric folk rock pioneer. He wasn't just changing his style. He was changing the entire path of songwriting.
And the proof is right there in its status. I mean, it's monumental. Released in 1965, it defied all conventional wisdom, reached number 2 on the U.S. Billboard charts.
Which... incredible for a song that long.
Incredible. And then decades later, in 2004, Rolling Stone magazine voted it the number 1 song of all time. It is, you know, unequivocally the benchmark.
Okay, so let's start with the context. What state was Dylan in when he wrote this? He's 24 years old, and he's writing this intensely hostile song. The sources say he was channeling something really personal, even hateful.
Well, it was a period of profound artistic conflict. Dylan was, at this stage, completely trapped by his own fame.
Right.
He was already a household name, hailed as the messiah of the folk movement, but he was just drowning in all the expectations. The protest movement, especially, was trying to own him.
They wanted him to be their clear voice, their spokesperson.
Yeah.
Exactly. And he felt like a captive. He'd just finished his final purely acoustic tour in England in May 1965, and the frustration was just immense. It wasn't just burnout. It was existential.
The sources suggest he was so dissatisfied he was seriously thinking about quitting music entirely.
And that's the beautiful tension that created the song. Instead of quitting, he just turns all that negative energy outward.
He goes into this manic phase of writing.
Totally manic. Stream of consciousness.
Yeah.
He sat down at a typewriter and reportedly hammered out a colossal 20-page long document.
20 pages? That's not a song. That's an act of pure emotional purging.
It was. It was filled with sarcastic verses and bitter comments and famously hatred directed at some point. He was just venting, you know, fighting back against the world he felt was trying to cage him.
Dylan himself called it channeling steady hatred and revenge.
Yeah. And the fascinating part is that if you read those early drafts, the anger is shapeless. It's all over the place. The genius move wasn't writing the 20 pages. It was the editing.
The cutting.
Precisely. He took that massive, venomous text, started shortening it, and tried singing it slowly at the piano. And that's when you realize the core power was in that refrain, in asking that rhetorical, loaded question.
How does it feel?
How does it feel? He described the pace of it as being like swimming in lava, slow, heavy, intense. The conflict was resolved not by quitting, but by turning his personal rage into this universal story of a downfall.
That anger really comes through, but what's the difference between this steady hatred and, say, a standard protest song? It feels so much more personal.
It is. A protest song deals with systems. This deals with the person, a target. And that intensity carried right over into the studio, where the recording process was just as revolutionary as the lyrics themselves.
Okay, this is where it gets really interesting. The sources say the musical foundation is actually surprisingly accessible. He used the chord progression from Ritchie Valens' La Bamba.
Yeah, as the skeleton of the song. It sounds completely original, but the structure is rooted in rock and roll history.
And that familiarity allowed him to build something completely new on top of it.
Right. So the session was June 15th and 16th, 1965, at Columbia Studio in Manhattan for the Highway 61 Revisited album. And what stands out immediately is the tension in the room.
Because there was no lead sheet. And for anyone listening who isn't deep into studio recording, a lead sheet is basically the sheet music. It's the map.
It's the map, chords, melody, structure. So you have these elite session players like guitarist Mike Bloomfield, who are used to reading everything perfectly on the first take.
And Dylan gives them nothing.
Nothing. They had to play completely by ear, adapting to his vision as they went.
There must have been chaos. The sources show the first attempts were confusing, and the early takes were actually in 34 time.
Yeah, waltz time. Can you imagine?
It's so jarring to even think about. It shows how much he was demanding total obedience to his vision. He basically told them how to play, and if they didn't want to, well, they couldn't play with him.
That intense direction led directly to friction. So much friction, in fact, that it led to a producer swap.
Right. His producer, Tom Wilson, he's replaced by Bob Johnston for the rest of the album. It was a really volatile environment.
But that volatility also produced the song's most iconic sound, the organ, the accidental organ part from Al Cooper.
I love this story. I mean, I didn't realize he basically snuck onto the instrument.
He was originally invited as a second guitarist, but then he hears Mike Bloomfield play and just thinks, I can't compete with that.
He thought he was fired.
He did. He retreated to the control room, but he couldn't stay away. He saw this unassigned Hammond organ, snuck back out, and just started playing along.
And he didn't even really know the chords. He said he was unsure of the changes.
Exactly, which is why the organ comes in just a little bit late in the first bridge. It sounds sort of tentative, like it's searching for the notes.
And that's what makes it so captivating. That's the sound. Producer Tom Wilson heard it and just loved it.
Loved it so much, he mixed the organ to be just as loud as the vocals and the band. Those melodic, slightly delayed notes became the sonic fingerprint of the song. It's an unbelievable detail.
The core identity of the song was a nervous guitarist trying not to mess up on an instrument he wasn't even hired to play.
And then, on top of all that, you have the great 6-minute standoff.
Oh, yeah. The song clocks in at 6 minutes and 13 seconds, Columbia Records. They were not happy.
They were losing their minds. They thought it was commercial suicide. The standard single at the time was, what, 3 minutes?
Barely. They refused to release it. They demanded cuts.
But Dylan just said no. Categorically refused to budge. This was artist versus commerce, and Dylan basically forced their hand.
And the fact that this impossible single became his greatest commercial hit just shattered the time limits for popular music forever. It proved complexity and length could work.
So the chaos in the studio created this revolutionary sound. But you're right, it was the lyrical venom that gave the song its immortality.
Yeah, let's step away from the Hammond organ and get into that scathing poetry.
The song is basically a detailed narrative. It's told from the perspective of an outside narrator judging this woman he calls Miss Lonely. It's a character study of her complete downfall.
She used to have everything, right? Went to the finest schools, lived a fine life. She even used to laugh at everybody that was hanging out, just completely insulated.
And the narrator just delivers this fatal blow. She loses everything. We see her descent when she loses the protection of her diplomat who carried on his shoulder a Siamese cat.
After he took everything he could steal, what do you think that image, the diplomat and the cat, what does it symbolize?
It's all about the superficiality of her privileged life. I mean, the diplomat is her connection to power and security, but he's a thief.
And the cat is just an accessory.
The ultimate accessory. A decadent symbol of status. When he leaves and steals everything, he strips away the entire foundation of her life, leaving her exposed on the street with no direction home.
And the narrator doesn't miss a chance to rub it in. He contrasts her past pride with her humiliating present. Now you don't talk so loud. Now you don't seem so proud.
About having to be scrounging your next meal? She's invisible now. No secrets to conceal. She even has to pawn her diamond ring.
The whole song is a confrontation of that privileged ignorance. Which brings us to the central metaphor, the Rolling Stone, which I think gets misunderstood a lot.
It does. We need to be clear about the proverb it's from. A Rolling Stone gathers no moss.
Now, traditionally, you know, that can be interpreted positively, especially here in America. It means you're free, you're restless, you're not burdened by things.
Right. But Dylan is using the negative, older English interpretation. In this context, gathering no moss means you gather no roots, no stability, no social connections.
So a Rolling Stone is...
It's a state of existential uncertainty and social anonymity. It's about being a homeless tramp without direction. The song isn't celebrating freedom. It's lamenting this devastating forced isolation.
Which makes that central question, how does it feel? Like a complete unknown, like a Rolling Stone. It makes it purely sarcastic.
Overwhelmingly sarcastic. It's the narrator's ultimate act of revenge, forcing her to feel the pain she once just laughed at.
And people have always speculated that the real-world subject was the actress Edie Sedgwick.
Yeah, that's the common theory. She was part of Dylan's scene in the mid-60s before, you know, her own tragic decline. The venom feels that specific.
So what does this all mean for music history? The song wasn't just a hit, it changed everything. It proved that rock music could be 6 minutes long, lyrically complex, deeply personal, and still dominate the charts.
Its success completely validated the shift toward more progressive rock, longer songs. It raised the ceiling for lyrical ambition in rock permanently.
And its influence is just. It's everywhere. Dylan himself has performed it over 2,000 times since 1965.
A testament to its power. And just think about the artists who covered it. Jimi Hendrix brought this whole new ferocity to it.
And the Rolling Stones, of course.
Of course. And we know that Prince, who was so selective about the music he admired, he named it as one of 55 songs that inspired his own art. That's a lineage that speaks volumes.
It's also interesting to trace the term itself, Rolling Stone. I mean, long before Dylan, it was Muddy Waters in 1950 with his song, Rolling Stone.
Which is where the band got their name from.
Right. So Dylan plugged into this deep existing tradition of the tramp metaphor, but he simultaneously electrified it and radically redefined it for the rock era.
He acknowledged the past while just completely blowing up the future.
Ultimately, this deep dive shows you that sometimes the greatest knowledge doesn't come from a textbook or the finest schools that Miss Lonely went to. It comes from the shock of radical change and loss.
It really is the ultimate lesson in forced empathy, all driven by Dylan's desire for revenge.
So to quickly summarize the key nuggets we found, the song's origin as this manic 20-page draft born from Dylan's steady hatred.
And the conflict over the 6:13 length, where Dylan forced the label to break the 3-minute rule, opening the door for complex rock singles.
Don't forget Al Kooper's happy organ blunder, where his uncertainty became the defining sound.
And critically, we have to remember that Rolling Stone metaphor is explicitly negative. It's about devastating social anonymity and existential uncertainty.
It's the ultimate critique of privilege, delivered as this vicious question that just refuses to let you look away.
And that leads to a final provocative thought for you to carry forward. The song is about confronting someone's sudden, devastating lack of privilege, right?
Right.
But consider the very last line. When you ain't got nothing, you got nothing to lose. If the protagonist finally achieved that state of having nothing to lose, what kind of power, or maybe what kind of pure, unburdened freedom might she have found that she fundamentally lacked when she was a protected princess on a steeple? Perhaps the end of the line, the loss of everything, is actually the beginning of her true unscripted journey.